And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
1 week till June. In schools across America, teachers are being ignored as students count the minutes till summer vacation. June is coming. In the Midwest, people are enjoying perhaps one of the best weeks of the year, that week before the mosquitoes hatch and begin that giant silent sucking sound. Hikers are getting ready for National Trails Day, from sea to shining sea, as we explore 50 ways to save the ocean, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
This last week in May just may be one of the best weeks of the year. It takes the best of spring, with its renewal of life, the propulsion of growth from seed upward to sun, and the joy of the springtime flowers, surrounded by the excited calls of various spring matings, the birds setting territories, frogs emerging from the mud, mayflies filling the mornings with clouds of frenzied frolic. And then comes June, as it ramps up to full spectrum of sunlight, suntans, and sunburns, as the specter of global warming becomes the hottest ticket at the box office, and a new hurricane season taunts us. So what else is new? Another summer dawns. And the first weekend in June also means that hikers all across America will be joining in to celebrate the 14th annual National Trails Day, June 3rd. And we here at the Wildside News are bringing you our third annual coverage of what's planned for that day and how you can participate. We talk with Ivan Levin of the American Hiking Society in our first segment. Then in segment two, summer also means heading to the beaches to meet and greet our oceans. We walk the shoreline, soak up the warm sun, and enjoy the watery vastness. The great oceans are always there for us. But below the surface, the oceans are changing. We've talked about it many times on the Wildside News. The truth about the decline of the ocean systems is perhaps one of the world's most perplexing problems. One can seem almost hopelessly at a loss to even know what to begin to do. Until now, that is. In segment two, we talk with a great ocean champion, journalist, author, and activist, David Helvarg, who has a new book out with 50 ways to save the ocean. Listening to David speak, there are thousands of things each of us can do, and every single action counts. And then in segment three, we head to Pennsylvania, to a place that set the stage for what was to become one of the greatest experiments in human history. Valley Forge. This National Historical Park celebrates a gathering of citizens who came together to fight for their freedom. We visit with Ernestine White about a gathering scheduled for June 3rd, as citizens again meet to celebrate National Trails Day. Great stuff coming up as soon as we take a look at this week's news. So first, the news. The debate over global warming is cooling off, while the debate over Al Gore is heating up. Al Gore is making headlines in everything from E! Magazine to Entertainment Tonight, with the release of his Globebuster, An Inconvenient Truth. The film, based on Gore's battle to awaken the world to the reality of global warming, is quite literally receiving rave reviews. Gore, fresh off the opening cameo on Saturday Night Live and an interview with Katie Couric Wednesday on the Today Show, launches his meteoric revival with interviews with Tom Brokaw on the NBC News, Terry Gross on Thursday, and the list goes on. Concurrent with the release of the movie is a book by the same title. Gore's movie is receiving endorsements from around the globe, and his media menagerie is making a difference. Of course, not everyone agrees with Mr. Gore. Tuesday on the Fox News Network, in its unending struggle to appear fair and balanced, interviewed Sterling Burnett, senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis, about An Inconvenient Truth. This is what Mr. Burnett had to say.
If I thought Al Gore's movie was, as you like to say, fair and balanced, I'd say everyone should go and see it. But why go see propaganda? You don't go see Joseph Goebbels' films to see the truth about Nazi Germany. You don't want to go see Al Gore's film to see the truth about global warming.
An inconvenient truth about the Center for Policy Analysis is that it has received more than $390,000 from ExxonMobil since 1998. Mr. Burnett wrote a recent editorial defending former Exxon CEO Lee Raymond's retirement compensation that provided him a stipend of $190,000 per day. Program note: The Wild Side News endorsed Al Gore for president during its second anniversary show this year on March 23rd, the first environmental news show in the world to do so. The chairman of the House Resources Committee, Representative Richard Pombo, ever vigilant to serve the American people, and particularly their oil companies, has introduced, once again, a bill to, okay, multiple choice. A, drill for oil off the coastal waters. B, drill for oil in Anwar. C, drill for oil everywhere. Correct answer, yes, he's messing with the caribou in Alaska. That's B. Previous attempts to drill in Anwar have used strategies including attaching such a provision to the defense spending bill, attaching it to the budget bill, to no avail. Pombo's newest bill stands boldly by itself, which opens up a potential filibuster when the bill is introduced in the Senate. The bill may be debated today. Stay tuned. Vice President Dick Cheney Monday flew into Stockton, California, hometown of Richard Pombo, to bolster his chances of winning against his arch-rival and former Republican Congressman Pete McCloskey, who opposes Pombo on his environmental credentials. Dick Cheney had nothing but high praise for the young congressman who has been launched to head the powerful House Resources Committee ahead of six longer-term Republicans. Mr. Cheney stated, "During my 10 years in Congress, I came to value individual congressmen who displayed toughness, values, intelligence, and resolve. Richard Pombo is that type of congressman, and he deserves it." Meanwhile, Dick Cheney's popularity continued to set record lows for a standing vice president, capturing the approval of at least 18% of the American voters. As yet, there is no study to determine if the following story indicates a trend in human-animal interactions, but in Cape Town, South Africa, gangs of baboons are invading expensive homes along the spectacular coast of South Africa's Cape Peninsula, acting like spring break monkeys of a human sort as they ravage pantries and refrigerators and wreak havoc on the she-she designer furniture. The baboons are becoming increasingly bold in their new surroundings, as the taste for upscale cuisine seems to be catching on in their social groups. Despite attempts to change their taste back to the wonders of the bush, the baboons, for now, are staging what appears to be the first evidence of radical thinking approaching fashionista complexity in non-human species. And on a happier note, otters and penguins forced to flee the ravages following Katrina, leaving the sanctuary of their homes at the Audubon Aquarium in New Orleans, are back home, following flights from Oakland on Monday back to New Orleans to be ready to greet visitors like in the good old days as the Audubon Aquarium reopens on Friday. And that's the news. In just over a week, you have the chance to have a great time joining in on the 14th annual National Trails Day. If you haven't attended one, this is as good a time as any. We who love the earth must come together now more than ever. Well, in the Wildside News' third year of shows, we also are setting some landmarks, and I'm really thrilled about this next landmark because this is the third annual coverage of the National Trails Day event that American Hiking Society is putting on, and joining us to talk about that is Ivan Levin with the American Hiking Society. Ivan, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you very much, Sydney.
This is your 14th year of the National Trails Day. Give us a sense of what your mission is and what this event really involves.
Well, National Trails Day is the signature trail awareness program for American Hiking Society. And basically, it's a day to inspire nearly 1 million trail enthusiasts to get to thousands of events nationwide celebrating public lands and trails and of course, human-powered recreation that takes place on those trails.
There are literally events in every single state.
There are, every single state, including Canada and Puerto Rico.
What's the best way for them to find out what's going on in their state?
The easiest way is to go to our website, which is www.americanhiking.org, and right at the top of the homepage, you'll see search for an event on National Trails Day, and you click on that, and then click on your corresponding state, and then you can click on the event that's in your local area from there.
One of the great things about this particular event is the fact that there's literally something for everybody. In some cases, people are going to be just going for a hike, but there's a lot of effort by local groups and organizations to help maintain trails, which is a huge part of what needs to be done, and with budget cuts and things like that, these volunteers out there working to clean up and maintain trails really serves a big purpose. Give us a sense of the variety of different things that people can participate in.
Well, there are a number of different types of events. Of course, you have your general hikes, which of course are front country and back country hikes, happening as part of National Trails Day. You also have, of course, your trail maintaining and constructing trips where people are actually going out, you know, on the ground and building trails, whether that's a bike trail or a hiking trail or whatnot. They're still out there building trails, including equestrian trails as well. There's also, besides the general events that happen on National Trails Day, we also have bird watching events, and there are trail races and marathons on National Trails Day. There's hikes in the evening for hikes by moonlight. There's also geocaching and letterboxing events. Of course, I mentioned trail maintenance. There's also events that are specific to exercising with your baby on trails and greenways. There's also, of course...
Now, is that a romantic... are you talking romantically or a children?
No, just with your your baby.
Oh, okay. Just want to make clear about that.
And, of course, there's also paddling and, like, kayak water trail trips on National Trails Day as well. Scavenger hunts for the kids and, of course, horseback and equestrian rides as well. And we even have some events where they're having gear swaps and how to learn new skills and how to learn the technical skills of hiking and biking and getting out on the trails. The theme this year is Experience Your Outdoors.
That's real basic and real simple, and that's exactly what National Trails Day fundamentally is all about.
Absolutely.
What's the advantage of getting out and connecting with the wild?
Well, I think that there's a number of experiences associated with this theme, Experience Your Outdoors on National Trails Day. First of all, it gives the program National Trails Day a personal message, which is meant to reach all individuals, and it's meant to include all varieties of recreational uses, as I've mentioned, hiking, biking, paddling, etc. The outdoor experiences on National Trails Day can really range from developing awareness and understanding for oneself and relationship with others, to encouraging responsibility, also building a sense of community, developing consciousness and respect for the environment, increasing a desire for recreation, enhancing quality of life, and of course providing exercise, relaxation, and enjoyment.
You know, it's amazing. Last year there were, it's posted, 1,132 events. That's a lot of activity out there. And what kind of numbers in terms of people do you see each year?
Well, let's see. And associated with 2005 National Trails Day, we had attendance that exceeded 121,000 trail enthusiasts at registered events. And that was a 16% increase from 2004. And, of course, we're expecting to see that trend in 2006 as well.
There's things happening all over. Give us an idea of some of the urban events that you think are exciting this year.
Just off the top of my head, there are there's a trail event festival happening in the Greensboro area of North Carolina. And it's a huge festival for the city where the city is actually being given an award for being a trail town, not from American Hiking Society, but they are receiving an award. And it's just all the citizens of Greensboro come out on National Trails Day and they celebrate all the different trails that Greensboro has to offer. There's also an event happening near the Washington, D.C. area on the Potomac Heritage National Scenic Trail, and this is also another example of a huge trail festival in a very urban, populated area where people are getting out and getting to learn the opportunities that are in their communities and the trails that are in their own backyard.
D.C. has an amazing network of trails for such an important urban center. How about some backcountry events?
Backcountry events, there's a number of events happening in California. I know that there are some happening in the Santa Monica Mountains, which are near L.A., but amazingly still backcountry events.
Yeah.
There's one happening that is being hosted by Coastwalk, which is an association that works with the California Coastal Trail in California. And this is happening in Carlsbad, California. And this is just a day to get out to learn about wildlife from a docent, and it's been a four-mile hike on a round-trip northern trail, and you're able to bring your lunch and water and relax and have some wildlife viewing in the backcountry while also participating in this four-mile hike as well.
One of the things that makes this all possible, too, are some regular and new corporate sponsors, Adventure Medical Kits, Backpacker Magazine. Why don't you tell some of the things that they may be involved with?
Sure, absolutely. In addition to Adventure Medical Kits and Backpacker Magazine, we also have EMS, Eastern Mountain Sports, Merrill Shoes, REI, Royal Robbins, Thor Lowe's, and we also work with a number of federal agencies as well.
Yeah, that's like the BLM and National Parks, U.S. Fish and Wildlife. And so it is truly a national spectrum event.
Absolutely.
And really exciting. Now, this is happening June 3rd. That's a Saturday.
Correct. National Trails Day is always the first Saturday of June.
Gotcha. Now, American Hiking Society at AmericanHiking.org is involved in lots and lots of different things, not just the National Trails Day, which certainly is a major event, but you also have some fascinating opportunities for people to spend some real time backcountry with your volunteer vacations.
Absolutely.
That's so neat. Talk about that.
Well, volunteer vacations is a great opportunity, and here in 2006, we're offering over 100 trips that are happening across the country, including Puerto Rico, and these are front country or back country trips, and basically you go out for a week at a time and you perform trail maintenance at all these amazing locations across the country. And typically for your small registration fee, your airport pickup and drop off is included, as well as your food, and you're just responsible for your airfare. And as I mentioned, we do have over 100 trips in 2006, and some of the trips that are coming up are happening in Golden Gate National Recreation Area, where participants are actually able to stay at the Presidio and then get to experience some of the cultural sites of San Francisco while during the day also working in Golden Gate National Recreation Area. So they're getting some of that front country experience by working on trails in an urban area and also getting to experience some of the cultural sites as well. And that's just a great example of some of our new front country trips that we're offering in 2006. And, of course, we have our usual back country trips where people are flying, you know, to obscure locations in Idaho, flying, getting picked up, and just spending a week out in the backcountry and then flying home.
Now, do they have to bring their own gear in a situation like that?
They do. Typically, participants do need to bring their own gear, backpack, sleeping bag, tents, depending on where they'll be staying. But typically, they do need to bring their own gear.
Another thing that American Hiking provides are funds for trail maintenance to various organizations.
Sure, absolutely. We have a grant program called the National Trails Fund, and it existed in the 90s, and then it went away for a little while, and it came back in 2005. And for 2006, we just awarded just over $50,000 to 17 different trail-maintaining organizations. And those funds went to support projects from building new trail and helping maintaining existing trail, to building constituency, to some land acquisition, to even helping fund some volunteers and interns for volunteer crews that are doing trail maintenance as well.
Now, of course, when people want to find out if there's things happening, they go to American Hiking, and there's a map, a pretty classic format for a website. It's really easy. I thought there must be one state that doesn't have something going, so I went to some classic states where I thought maybe there might not be. But you know what? Every single state has something. I noticed that in Louisiana, apparently, probably they're a little still trying to recover, so there weren't as many things happening there. But in some states, I'm telling you, there's literally, 50 to 75 events. Alaska, Hawaii, Alabama, Maine, there's things happening everywhere. People go to AmericanHiking.org to find out. Ivan Levin, let's talk a little bit about you. How is it that you come to be so enthusiastic about trails?
Well, my educational background, my bachelor's degree is actually in recreation parks and tourism with a concentration of outdoor recreation. And I interned with American Hiking Society as kind of the last credits for my degree. And I fell in love with the organization and our mission and what the organization was all about. And I was actually offered a position as trail programs manager summer of 2004.
You lucky guy.
Yeah. So I've been with American Hiking now for just about 2 years, and I absolutely love it. And I'm also in graduate school getting my master's in park and recreation resource management as well.
What's your favorite activity?
You know, I love going on 1 to 3 day hikes, you know, where I'm able to spend a couple days out in the backwoods and for a few days and just being able to step away from everybody and everything and then being able to come back when I want to.
That is restorative. That's obviously why it's important for people to experience the outdoors. And I think a lot of us get so wrapped up in life that we sometimes feel as if it's difficult to get away, but that's one of the aspects about hiking that is so nice. You can go for a hike and experience the outdoors with a pair of shoes and a little proper clothing.
Absolutely.
Ivan Levin, I want to thank you for telling us about the National Trails Day. Also, now, if people want to become a member of American Hiking Society, how do they do that?
Well, the easiest way, of course, is to go onto our website, which is AmericanHiking.org, and right there on the homepage, you can see a join or renew screen right there, and you can just join right there online, or feel free to contact someone in the office, and we'll be happy to help you from there.
Yeah, what's that number?
The number is 301-565-6704.
Well, we're looking at the 14th Annual National Trails Day happening all over, all across the United States. Ivan Levin, thanks so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Sydney.
Take a look at what's happening in your area. Then set aside Saturday, June 3rd. I guarantee a great adventure to everyone who does. All across America, people will be celebrating from sea to shining sea. But it's becoming clear that our oceans are in deep trouble. It can seem at times so overwhelming. In just a moment, you're going to have 50 great things to do to help save the oceans. Did you know that getting married can actually help? Find out how when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Okay, after this next segment, you'll have no excuse anymore for not helping to save the oceans from what many are saying may just be the end of the oceans as we've known them within the next 10 years. Sure, we can talk about it. But really, now it's time to do something. All of us, and that includes you, and me, and all of our friends. There's a new book out that makes saving the oceans fun and doable. It's 50 Ways to Save the Ocean, when your Voice of the Earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
I'm fortunate enough to be able to look out my window and see the vast blue ocean out down here in San Diego. It appears in many respects to be this beautiful, beautiful, it's actually a long curved line. But underneath that long curved line is an infinite world of wonder that most people have almost no real comprehension about. Those who have taken the time to really explore what's below the blue line have a lot of stories to tell, and some of the stories are a little bit shocking sometimes about what's happening below the blue line. One of the people who's been involved in this for a very long time as a journalist, as a writer, as an activist, is David Hallvarg, who is now joining us from Washington, D.C. David, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney.
Well, David, you've been involved with oceans for a very long time. You've had a multiplicity of careers. Why don't you give us a kind of a background on how it is that you've gotten to this point?
Right. Well, I've been a journalist for some 30 years, including 10 where you are on the beach in San Diego, and most of my career was kind of schizophrenic. I'd go off and cover wars and epidemics and politics and then come home to the beach where I'd go body surfing or go out on dive trips and, you know, always kid having this fascination with the ocean, you know, growing up on Long Island Sound and, you know, the swamps behind my public school, wanting to, as a kid, be a Navy frogman and sort of fight for America and dolphins, and then later wanting to be an oceanographer until I got caught up in the movements and the moments of my youth, became an activist and then a journalist, went off to Northern Ireland and then settled into San Diego, where, as I say, I body surfed and went off, covered wars in Central America for 5 years with a friend, John Hoagland, who was a goofy-footed surfer, used to surf the left break at La Libertad in El Salvador between covering the wars and insurrections, and eventually got around to writing the book I always wanted to, Blue Frontier, on the state of U.S. oceans. And kind of as I saw it, a chance to get beyond that schizophrenia to really dedicate my myself to that other 71% of the planet that I was engaged in. It's 71% of its surface. It's actually about 97% of its living habitat. The first edition of Blue Frontier came out about 5 years ago. I got a call out of the blue from Ralph Nader, who'd read it. We sat down, talked about the last chapter called The Seaweed Rebellion, describing what I call the marine grassroots, watermen and waterwomen I'd found around the country who have practical solutions, who really have begun to work to correct some of the cascading disasters we're seeing in the ocean. And at the time, I'd lost someone. I was depressed. I was thinking of going back to war reporting. And after these discussions and making calls to different people I knew, surfers, scientists, fishermen, people who I'd spoken to as a journalist, and they all agreed I wasn't stepping on anyone's fins. And so I felt that maybe it made more sense to try and organize this what I call seaweed marine grassroots constituency and try and turn things around from the bottom up. I just had the feeling that if I went back to war reporting, we're kind of likely to always have wars. We may not always have living reefs and kelp forest and wild fish. And so I decided to go with the love I still had that was still alive, although, again, in critical condition. I mean, we have, as I say, cascading disasters from industrial overfishing for the global seafood market, coastal pollution from urban agricultural runoff. We have coastal sprawl that's cementing over the salt marshes and wetlands and mangrove swamps that act as the filters and nurseries of the sea that are essential if we're going to restore our living seas. And then finally, we have fossil fuel-fired climate disruption that's eroding beaches, raising sea levels, bleaching corals globally, and even changing the very chemistry of the sea, acidifying it. So in 2003, we started the Blue Frontier campaign and have been working ever since to try and link these. We've identified, we put out a directory of some 2,000 seaweed groups, citizen activists and organizations and institutions working for the restoration of our public seas. And we've had conferences, both national and regional conferences, bringing folks together. Most recently, we put out this new book, 50 Ways to Save the Ocean, that we're hoping can get out beyond the activist community to anyone who really loves the ocean and wants to know what they can do.
Bluefront.org is the way you get to Blue Frontiers, which is the website, and it's the organization that you've organized.
Blue Frontier Campaign, named it after the book. Figure that's a classic example of recycling, you know, trying to be the good enviro.
Exactly. Talk about that. Talk about Blue Frontier Campaign. Sort of when you speak to your people, what's the message that you feel they need to know so that they can be effective?
Strength and unity. I mean, we've seen there are lots of practical solutions that are being applied at a local level. The question is how we scale it up to the state, regional, national, and global level. And I think we do that through showing that there is a constituency out there, Sam Farr, who's a Democratic congressperson out of California, said to me that California has better ocean policy basically because people here vote the coast and ocean, and politicians understand if they don't vote the right way to protect and restore and explore our living seas, they could actually feel the consequences come election day. And so we had an initial Blue Vision conference in 2004 that brought 250 activists from more than 170 organizations in 23 states and territories. And we came to Washington. We kind of increased, you know, our skills levels, had panels on media and organizing, and then went up on the Hill and met with three senators, a dozen congresspeople, and have sent the message that, you know, there have been two major ocean commissions and that put out over 300 recommendations for change. They both agreed we need ecosystem-based management. And they both said, you know, led one commission led by a lifelong Democrat, Leon Panetta, the other by a lifelong Republican, Admiral Jim Watkins. And yet both commissions agreed that without a, you know, approach to sustain the living systems of the oceans, we're seeing a threat to our nation's economy, its environment, and its national security in the collapse of these marine systems. And they both came back to Washington about 6 weeks ago, both the Admiral and Leon Panetta, and gave the White House and Congress a report card. They gave it a D+, which I think they were still grading on a curve. I think there's a failure at the top. Politicians I've found being based here in Washington for over 8 years tend to be a bit like sharks or rays. They're hardwired to certain stimuli, and those tend to be not how much you can educate them, but can you give them money or can you give them votes? And if people who love the ocean and understand it belongs to all of us may not have the money of the shipping industry or offshore oil and gas or coastal real estate interest, but we have the votes and in their districts, and people have the opportunity to give back. I mean, the 50 Ways to Save the Ocean, it talks about how we can change things both as individuals acting from the heart, but also as consumers and as citizens. So we suggest things like visiting the beach, you know, and just packing out what you pack in and taking the litter bag and cleaning up the plastic that's so ubiquitous there and is a constant polluter. And then we talk about other things that, you know, along with visiting an aquarium, being a responsible boater and diver, things that people don't normally associate with the ocean, like conserving energy, because half the electricity in this country is generated by coal-fired power plants. And the pollution that goes up the smokestack, I mean, it's the most carbon-intensive fossil fuel, and so that coal contributes to global warming and the melting of glaciers and the slowing down of the circulation that drives the Gulf Stream. And at the same time, coal also releases the neurotoxin mercury, which rains out into our oceans and goes through the food web where it's concentrated and ends up back in our tuna fish sandwiches. And when you save energy, you also save money. You know, it's your health and your money, as well as a healthier sea you're creating. And finally, we talk about things like going to local planning board meetings, to local government meetings. A woman in New Jersey stood up, and there the local townships were using eminent domain to take down low-income beach communities and replace them with private high-rise condo developments. The so-called public good they were claiming was increased tax revenue. She said it just made her feel hopeless. I said she should feel outraged, because there are 563 townships in New Jersey, and only outraged citizens are going to make the time commitment to go to the zoning board meeting to confront the developers and say, these are our public beaches. We want the access. We want the views. This is what they did in California 30 years ago with the Coastal Commission, and the benefits are there even today. And finally, talk about boating the coast and being a seaweed rebel, you know, engaging in as many levels of activism as you can. It takes commitment, but we get so much from the ocean in terms of recreation and transportation, trade and energy, and just that sense of awe and wonder of being part of a larger blue planet, that I think people really do want to give something back.
You've laid out the matrix, and part of the challenge is the fact that it is so incredibly complex and interconnected that I think for a lot of people, they don't really know where to come in, and maybe that's a good entry point to this whole process. I've learned over the years that no matter what it is you want to dedicate yourself to, it's going to take everything you've got, all of your time. If you want to save an endangered tree in your neighborhood, that's going to take all your time to organize and whatever else. If you're trying to protect a national forest in your state, it's going to take all your time. If you want to save the world, it's going to take all your time. So you kind of have to choose who you serve.
Right, and a lot of the interconnections, though, a lot of the 50 ways to save the ocean are choices that people don't immediately connect them with the ocean, particularly if they're inland. But, you know,
good point. Mm-hmm.
Choosing to eat vegetarian or organic may not seem like an ocean-saving action, but you're reducing the amount of petrochemical-based fertilizers and synthetic herbicides being used on crops. And when they're using 140 pounds per acre in the Midwest, all that surplus is falling gravity down the Mississippi River, where it's growing a second crop of algae that then decays and sucks the dissolved oxygen out of the water creates these massive dead zones that have now become a global problem.
Yeah.
And so individual choices that you may decide to do to benefit your own health or to, you know, improve agriculture in America to support family farming also supports the ocean. And as I say, once you start doing one or two things, there's that tendency to get more involved. I think the book tries to keep it light and informative. You know, we've got Jim Toomey, who does Sherman's Lagoon cartoons, did all the illustrations, and Philippe Cousteau, who's the grandson of Jacques, wrote the intro. It's kind of showing that there's continuity and that the struggle really never ends. And what you say is true, Sidney. I mean, I think that ultimately it does become altruism, getting outside yourself and making a commitment to something larger can become a life's commitment. And so, you know, what are the trade-offs, though? Less time at the mall, we watch less reality television as we begin to alter reality itself.
When people think about the oceans, part of the challenge is the fact that, I mean, one way to look at this, I talked with Dr. Kennel, for example, over at Scripps, and boy, a guy who really has a perspective. The Pew Commission, for example, is talking about the fact that we have to think about the various kind of levels of the ocean. One is the ocean right in your backyard here. For those people who live in coastal areas, you know, that's where you're going to have the most direct impact, and that's one way in which you have the opportunity to really impact what's happening in your local area there, and that is to utilize a lot of the concepts that you have in 50 Ways to Save an Ocean, but to get involved at that level. Then as well, you have the wider spectrum, the 200-mile continental
economic zone.
Exactly right, which now starts to deal with interstate and in many cases, international issues as well, and that's another area where there has to be regulation and control and awareness, and people have an opportunity to get involved. And then as well, you have literally the global challenge that has to do with fishing, overfishing, bottom dredging, pollutants and toxins and other things of that nature, what's happening in the military and the soundings, the oil exploration. And we actually, all three of those are involved. And you have an opportunity to think that way as to where you wish to work.
And then sometimes you have to work all three levels. It's interesting, when I visited Aquarius, this underwater research lab, Steve Miller, who was directing it, said, we used to say, think globally, act locally. He says, but the impacts the reef's feeling are local and regional and global, and in today's world, we really have to think and act at all levels at once.
Exactly right, and that's ultimately what we're all trying to do. 50 Ways to Save the Ocean is produced by InterOcean Books. I like the concept, InterOcean. It has to do with deeper levels of commitment and awareness and action, and I really appreciate that. It's a great book. It's a paperback book. It's a real fast, easy, fun read. There's a number of things I like about it. One is the fact that you've kind of broken this down into five approaches. If you start off by just saying enjoy. Just enjoy. Keep it simple. And that, you know, you're right. If you can't enjoy the ocean, well, then perhaps this isn't for you. But learn to enjoy. And you have some really great ideas. One of which that I think was the second one in here, was to get married on the ocean. I actually did that. And it's fun things like that. And we're going to go into this a little bit more. Secondly is conserve. So you have a number of actions to help people know how they can conserve. Clean. Get out there and help to keep things clean from many different perspectives. Everything from beach cleanups to watching the runoff that ultimately will lead to the ocean, and protection. Protecting creatures from, one of the things that you've talked about here is plastics. I'd love to talk about that a little bit, because that's a scary realm. And then also learn and share. The other thing about the book is the fact that, as I say, it's an easy read, but then as well with each one of these topics, and for example with conserve, there's probably about 10 different actions. And then you actually have actions that you can utilize. So it's very hands-on, very simple things. It's a guidebook. And a person can go through and start to do these actions. And in that process, it leads to working locally, regionally, and globally all at the same time. So I really enjoy that. And then at the end of the book, for each one of the 50 actions, there's also a listing of organizations that you can turn to if you want to find out more information. It's a great book. Also, where can people find the book, David?
Thank you. Well, you can find it hopefully in your local independent bookstore. If not, the chain stores are also carrying it. Of course, it's on Amazon and the other online sources. And increasingly, we're getting it into aquariums and, you know, other marine-themed centers, maritime museums and the like.
In the realms of enjoy, I'll just read through some of these. Go to the beach, get married on a wild beach, dive responsibly,
take only pictures and leave only bubbles.
Yeah, I love that. Visit a tide pool, take kids surfing.
Or have them take you.
And there you go. Talk about ocean, your place of worship. Let's enjoy. And those are important. In terms of conserving, do you have one of the conservation principles that you think is particularly relevant?
Well, I was saying it's, you know, some things that we don't think of as particularly ocean-oriented, but like eating more organic or vegetarian foods, because it's not only healthful, but it reduces the amount of runoff. You know, a lot of our industrial farming, you have the factory farms in Chesapeake Bay, the chicken industry is concentrated there with a lot of polluted runoff, and the floodplains of North Carolina is where the hog industry really concentrated initially cheap land that also flooded in 99 and caused massive die-offs of plants, marine plants and ecosystems offshore. And even the growing of industrial corn and soy in the Midwest, they use 140 pounds of petrochemical fertilizers and herbicides, and all that surplus ends up following gravity down streams and rivers into the Mississippi, where it grows a second crop of algae in the Gulf of Mexico every spring flood. The result is that decays is eaten by bacteria that take out the dissolved oxygen from the water. Everything that can't flee dies. It's grown to 8,000 square miles, and it's one of some 146 dead zones in the world oceans, a third of them in the U.S. So when we eat organic or vegetarian food, we reduce that those chemical inputs that poison the seas. At the same time, if we support local farmers and eat locally, we're shortening the lines of transportation that add additional fossil fuels that overheat the planet and impact the oceans. So, you know, that sort of thing, but the same with conserving energy in your home. And, you know, there are practical ways of maybe less relevant in San Diego, but in New England, for example, using an energy-efficient humidifier in winter. You know, humidity will increase the heat index, actually. So 68 degrees will feel like 73. You save energy, and at the same time, you're reducing those emissions of coal-fired power plants that are overheating the planet, adding coal being the most intense carbon add-on to the atmosphere. And at the same time, those coal-fired plants are putting out mercury, a neurotoxin that is concentrated in the ocean, particularly by plastic in the ocean, concentrates those kind of pollutants and neurotoxins and takes it back up the food web into the tuna fish sandwich we might eat. So there are many practical ways to protect and conserving energy. Using less plastic, as I say, is a huge thing. It may be the most underrated of oceanic pollutants that people aren't aware that plastic never goes away.
Actually, the way in which you talked about it briefly in the book, that plastic is forever, I really wasn't aware of the way in which we think of plastic, let's say a plastic cup or something, we leave it on the beach, but it's what happens after that that is the silent killer story. It's an untold story, one that we can't see, but wow, it's very significant.
And I saw it, unfortunately, in the wake of Katrina, was when I was down reporting on the hurricane impacts, where all along the Mississippi coast, the trees and wetlands were just festooned with plastic. It looked like Buddhist prayer flags. Buddhists prayed for dead turtles, and the beaches were, you know, when you blow thousands of homes away, it's an amazing amount of plastic that emerges, and the polymers, the styrofoam, was breaking into little pellets that the birds were beginning to feed on. What happens is all that plastic waste, plastic bags, for example, look a lot floating in the water like jellyfish, which is sea turtles' favorite snack food. And so a lot of turtles and birds will eat plastic remnants and either choke or simply fill their stomach so much with plastic residue that they're unable to get their natural foods, and they literally starve to death. But the plastic continues to break down, unlike a oil slick, which will eventually biodegrade. These polymers remain in the ocean, forming a fine plastic dust that has been concentrated in the central gyre of the Pacific, for example. And that gyre brings it into big floats of plastic, but also fine plastic dust that there's 6 pounds of it for every pound of phytoplankton in the mid-Pacific where they've researched.
And that's just astonishing.
And it's scary, and it's also like a sponge for persistent organic pollutants, for chlorinated chemical compounds like DDT and PCBs. And so it concentrates the pollutants which then work their way up the food chain or the food web back into our diet. We have this bad tendency to eat the top predators of the ocean, the sharks and tunas and swordfish. And that's where you have the pollution, the circle of poison coming back to us. And it's hard to remember that plastic hasn't always been ubiquitous. I mean, it was only developed in World War II. Plastic and rayon were developed as substitutes for cotton and rubber that we couldn't access. And rayon, I think, reached its apotheosis with the development of the Aloha shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe its low point with the leisure suit in the 70s, but plastic has become this cheap, universal byproduct of petroleum. And there's so many ways to get along without it that we suggest a number of them in the book. You know, just
well, unfortunately for the creatures in the sea, they don't even know it's there. I mean, they're living in this environment, and it's kind of like genetically modified food products that we eat without even knowing that we're doing it, and yet there's long-term consequences. The concept that the animals in the sea are living in a plastic-rich environment with these almost microscopic-sized bits of plastic is, wow, that's an eye-opener for me.
They're living in our wastes, and, you know, it's not that long ago. I remember when I lived in San Diego in the late 70s and 80s, there were still scientists who said the solution to pollution is dilution, believing that the oceans could absorb any abuses we heaped on them. And now, you know, many science reports and two major ocean commissions later, people realize that there is a tipping point, and we have to make sure that there's a lot of resiliency in the ocean if we establish fully protected marine parks where there's no extraction and let the fish grow back to size and the other critters and ecosystems and habitats, they can bound back, but there are limits, and we don't know how close we've come to pushing those limits. Admiral Jim Watkins, who headed up the Bush-appointed U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy, thinks we have 5 to 10 years to turn things around before it's too late. So we're not talking about change in our lifetime. We're talking about change in this decade and maybe the following.
A lot of the warnings that people talked about years and years ago are now proving true, although they've been decimated and every attempt has been heaped upon them to destroy. Talks about, for example, plastics and the dangers that they would become in the oceans. It's happening now. I guess maybe the good side of this is the fact that people are beginning to actually pay attention.
Yeah, I am seeing this sort of upsurge of citizen activism and the linkages. I mean, one of what we've tried to do at the Blue Frontier Campaign is just bring different constituencies together, because there's a proposal for an American Oceans Act at the level of the Clean Air or the Clean Water Act. And you look back in the last century, the kind of coalitions that formed to pass the Clean Air Act, for example, of the Steelworkers Union and public health officials and environmentalists. And we see the potential today with surfers and surfer activists like the Surf Rider Foundation, mm-hmm. with water keepers, with aquariums and institutions and coastal businesses that understand that their economic futures are dependent on healthy and bountiful seas. We've got Longshore Union fighting for cleaner ports and shipping. We have coastal tribes that are engaging at their level of governance. And so I am hopeful that, we know how to do it the right way. We know what the answers are. It's a question of creating the will and the blue movement we need to make sure it happens.
What I've found, particularly having done the Wild Side News for a couple of years now, it always amazes me how many people are out there. Every community has people who are working for the right ends and are affecting their communities. We don't hear about that too much. We don't get a sense of just really how many people there are that are so truly concerned. That's our mission.
Right. I mean, last year we put out, in 2005, we put out the Ocean Coastal Conservation Guide. And among other things, it lists and describes some 2,000 organizations around the U.S. Working for the restoration and protection of our coastal and ocean resources, mm-hmm. and we put a lot of that on our website as well at bluefront.org to give people a tool to just link up with people and their neighbors and fellow activists in their marine watersheds and in their coastal areas.
Well, there is an opportunity it's not an opportunity. We're way past opportunity. There is a requirement now that we stop playing games with the truth and that we start to truly organize, truly get busy, take this seriously, because You know, it's funny because people talk about 5 or 10 years. When the global warming debate began, people were talking about the oceans rising perhaps an inch and a half in the next 100 years. And, of course, therefore, it wasn't an issue. But those numbers have really, really, really changed. And now people are talking about feet in the next 20 years. 20 years turns into 10 years, 10 into 5, and these changes are going to be happening very soon. Five to 10 years is no time at all.
No, and we're in a crisis state, and crisis is also opportunity, but the question is, do we mobilize in time? I mean, we know that the warming seas act as a supercharger for hurricanes. The 04 and 05 seasons were, you know, if nothing, tremendous wake-up calls. We got 1 million environmental refugees in our country last fall.
I never thought about that. That's exactly what that is, though, yeah. Mm-hmm. Environmental refugees, wow.
And it's where we turn natural disasters into human catastrophes by ignoring the key issues like wetlands, like coastal development, like energy and climate. We can't ignore it anymore. I mean, we can, but at our own peril.
Interestingly enough, all of these topics have been covered by thousands, literally millions of people over the last 20, 30 years in detail. Hopefully we can find a means to pull all this information together and unite our spirits and our efforts. This is our challenge for this generation and this bunch of people on this planet right now.
Absolutely. We have to intensify our means of communication like Wildside News, and we also have to intensify our commitment. And as I say, it's, you know, we get so much out of our ocean planet that we really have to get serious as individuals and act from the heart and keep faith with what anthropologist Margaret Mead said years ago, 60 or 70 years ago. She said, you know, don't doubt a small group of individuals can change the world. Nothing else ever has. And so it's each of us making commitment that leads to the creation of new social movements that hopefully can turn the tide in time.
Well, I certainly encourage every single person out here who's listening to this show to take that to heart and realize that we must unite. We really must. I don't know how else to say it anymore. We simply must. Otherwise, we're going to live in a depleted, bleak, desperate, helpless world, and that's stupid. David Halvert with the Blue Frontier Campaign,
bluefront.org,
correct. Any parting thoughts here?
You know, just hope people will read the book and be inspired and get in touch with us or their local seaweed activists and, you know, decide to give something back. Because even on a recent book trip, I got to go snorkeling with some manatees and, you know, get out on some wild beaches and see that there's a lot there worth saving still.
Well, there's about 1,000 good ideas in this book, and they're real easy to just pick a few. Pick 20, and you'll make a difference. That's the truth. Everyone who makes any kind of difference affects the entire system. That's just the way it works. David Halvert, thanks so much for adding your voice to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney.
Psst. If we don't really do something, and between all your efforts to save the oceans, you might as well go out and enjoy a great hike. We're heading off to Valley Forge as they prepare for next weekend's National Trails Day. Stay tuned.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Our look at National Trails Day continues now as we head on out to Valley Forge National Historical Park, where in 1977-1978, about 1,200 men spent months in tents, cooking on open fires, hiking and preparing their gear for a revolution. This original encampment, this June 3rd, will see another gathering of campers and hikers who celebrate the freedom of our open places as the 14th annual National Trails Day continues here on the Wild Side News. With over 1,000 celebrations of National Trails Day occurring across America this June 3rd, there's plenty of time to make plans to attend. We visit just one of the gathering places as we head on over to one of America's founding lands, Valley Forge National Historical Park. National Trails Day is coming up on June 3rd, and we're covering this amazing event that has activities happening all across America, over 1,000 activities in every state in the Union. Right now, we're going to find out about something that's happening at the Valley Forge National Historical Park. Joining us to talk about this and tell us what's planned is Ernestine White. Ernestine, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you.
How are things out there today?
Today, it's very beautiful. It's sunny. The weather is perfect.
Great. You've been with the Park Service for a while. Right now, you're the volunteer coordinator at Valley Forge. You have something planned for June 3rd, National Trails Day. As a matter of fact, you have a lot of stuff going on. Quite a busy day.
Yeah, we have an excellent schedule. The park has, again, teamed up with Eastern Mountain Sports. We've been working with Eastern Mountain Sports since 2004 in planning activities for National Trails Day. And this year, for the first time, Unilever has joined us as a sponsor. So this year, Valley Forge is working with Eastern Mountain Sports and Unilever to plan activities for National Trails Day.
Well, I've read about your activities that are planned on the American Hiking Society's website related to National Trails Day, and it sounds like people are going to find a lot going on in Valley Forge on June 3rd.
Yes, they will. There will be all sorts of activities, some educational, fun activities, as well as an opportunity to get your hands dirty and help us with some volunteer projects preserving the trail system at the event. So we will have some educational clinics planned that will be presented by Healthy Parks, Healthy Living, which is Lipton's Live Well Challenge, Delaware Valley Orienteering Association, Leave No Trace, Eastern Mountain Sports have many clinics planned, kayaking, intro to kayaking, bike demos, basic bike maintenance, and demo hikes. So they have a lot of educational clinics planned, as well as some hikes that the park is planning. And again, as I said, an opportunity to volunteer to help with doing some trails maintenance.
So actually something for everybody. You can just come out and enjoy a nice hike.
Yes.
As well, you can learn about gear. Sounds like you can get in the water and try out a lot of different gear.
Exactly.
From EMS in particular. Obviously, one of the things that really makes National Trails Day succeed is the extraordinary number of volunteers who are out there really doing things that otherwise a lot of staff people who are stretched so often in the national parks and other parks and systems can't take care of. And I understand you've got friends and volunteers at Valley Forge National Historical Park.
Absolutely. Our trail system alone has 90% of it is being maintained by volunteers from such groups as Appalachian Mountain Club, Boy Scouts of America, school groups, universities. So without the help of volunteers, that resource would be in trouble. We definitely appreciate all the work that the volunteers do for us at the park in helping us to preserve the trail system.
Someone wants to become a volunteer, what should they do?
If they would like to become a volunteer, they can, again, visit our website or contact me, Ernestine White, at 610-783-1065.
Well, you're a great spokesman for this event. I wish I was out there because it sounds like a really terrific time. You've done a great job in helping to organize this.
Oh, man, this is going to be fantastic. We have, for the first time, all of the regional Eastern Mountain stores involved in our event. Usually we work with one store.
Wow.
So this year the district decided they wanted all the stores to participate, so that is big for us. And we have a lot of great environmental organizations and other healthcare organizations that I just think that are going to contribute so much to the event, as well as having Lipton Tea. And we do have some fun educational opportunities for the volunteers. And we didn't talk about the rock climbing wall and having a radio station MC in the event as well.
Oh, cool.
So that's what we will have happening. So we just need sun.
Yeah.
No rain. So, you know, because it traditionally rains on Trails Day. Last year was the first National Trails Day where we had sun. And I just wanted to take a picture of the sky.
best come prepared in case it does decide to...
This is a rain or shine event.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So come prepared in case it rains and still have lots of fun.
Exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about Valley Forge Park. First of all, how big is the park?
Valley Forge Park is about 4,000 acres.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, Valley Forge is a legendary name in American history. For those people who have kind of forgotten about exactly the significance of that, tell us a little bit about what the park is about.
Valley Forge National Historical Park educates present and future generations of Americans about one of the most defining events in our nation's history by preserving the natural and cultural resources that commemorate the encampment of the Continental Army at Valley Forge in 1777 and 1778.
Now, you've preserved a number of the historic buildings and battlefields at the park?
Yes, we actually don't have battlefields. Valley Forge, can also be known as the first American boot camp.
Yeah, that's
basically
really
a training ground.
That's really what it was. That's correct, yeah. And do you know how many troops were stationed there when they were going through their training, which was very rigorous?
Yes, I believe there was over 1,200.
Mm-hmm. This was the first time that these troops had to be organized. I believe there's even some of the artifacts that belonged to George Washington on display there.
Sure, we have a museum that have artifacts that are one of a kind that you will not see anywhere else in the United States. So we do have some artifacts that relates to the encampment.
Is there camping available?
There is no camping on the grounds here at Valley Forge. However, we do have some camping sites that are very near to the park. They would have to camp somewhere else and then commute maybe 20 to 30 minutes to Valley Forge.
I know that you've worked a lot on trails as well. But can you tell us about the trails at the park for people who want to take a little hike?
If they want to take a hike, what's great, this year for the first time, we've again started bike tours so they can rent a bike and they can visit the park that way. They can either, we do, where our trail system is open up for equestrians, hiking. We do have several different types of trails. We have the Joseph Plum Martin Trail, which is a 6.5-mile trail that leads you through the historic areas in the park. And also we have non-paved trails, some hiking trails that go through some of the steeper, I guess we would say mountains. I would hate to say mountains, but we do have some hiking trails that are a bit challenging, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have trails that are along the Schuylkill River as well as Valley Creek, which are beautiful trails providing scenery of the water and that sort of thing. There's various different ways that you can, experience the park. We do have a tour where you can do in your car. We give you a cassette or, I should say, a DVD, and it's about a 45-minute ride, and it talks about the history of the park. Or you could do a bike tour. There's walking tours, ranger-led walking tours. And also, you can go on your own with a map and just experience the historic areas on your own, hiking the trails to the park.
Also, there's water activities in terms of the river itself and kayaking. What is this challenging, or is it kind of gentle water? What can people expect who might do the kayak trip?
Yeah, the kayaking is going to be basic. It's going to be, we're going to have some experts from Eastern Mountain Sports. Actually, Eastern Mountain Sports have a kayaking school, so they'll have some of their instructors there.
Oh, great.
And they will help instruct people, the visitors that come out to the event, on how to properly use kayaks. And they'll keep it very basic, so someone who's not very familiar will feel very comfortable using the kayak.
I know a lot of times these corporate sponsors really put on quite an event. Tell me more about some of the things that are happening on National Trails Day on June 3rd.
Yeah, one great thing that we're doing, we have Healthy Parks and Healthy Living, which is presented by Lift and Live Well Challenge. And what they're going to do this year is they're creating a post that commemorates the event at Valley Forge and a T-shirt. They're doing T-shirts for us as well for all the participants and volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
Eastern Mountain Sports every year always has wonderful giveaways. They give away trips as well as gear that range up to $500. We'll have organizations like healthcare organizations like the YMCA, Gold's Gym. We'll have chiropractors there. We'll have other environmental and conservation organizations there. And all of these organizations have giveaways for the public at the event. So fun stuff that they can give away, educational things as well.
Well, it's always great to come to an event like that, particularly for local and regional folks, because they get a chance to see what's really going on. They learn a lot about their region, meet a lot of good folks. As a park worker, I think you know this, you're blessed to work in a park because some of the most amazing people spend their times in the parks. I've worked in parks myself, and people just really like to get along and have a great time.
Yes, and I find National Trails Day to be an excellent event for us to partner with other conservation healthcare organizations to present educational and fun activities, you know, basically focusing on the benefits of trails. So it's always great to work hand-in-hand with other organizations in the community to provide great opportunities for the public.
Now, for people who want to find out how to get to Valley Forge National Park, give us a kind of a visual map. What's the best way to find it?
Well, the best way, you can either go from Philadelphia, you can use the Schuylkill Expressway, I-76, or the Pennsylvania Turnpike. And Pennsylvania Turnpike, which is 276, I-276. If you're using the Pennsylvania Expressway, you want to get off at the Mall Boulevard exit. And everyone knows about the King of Prussia Mall. So you're going to take the Mall Boulevard exit. And at the end of the ramp, you make a right and continue straight through about six traffic lights, and you're right at the Welcome Center entrance. So you're right at the park's entrance there.
Now, Ernestine, for people who want to find out exactly what's going on and how to contact you folks, what's the best way to do so?
The best way would be to visit our website at www.nps.gov/VASO. So that's www.nps.gov/VASO. Or you can call our Welcome Center at 610-783-1077.
I have to assume you have the classic National Park Service email, Ernestine_White@nps.gov?
Yes, and that would be another way that you can find out detailed information about the event or about volunteer opportunities at the park or any other educational programming that we are planning this summer.
So when do things get started in the morning and how late they're going to go at night?
Well, they get started at 9 a.m. and continue and go through to 3 p.m.
Well, Ernestine White, volunteer coordinator at Valley Forge National Historical Park, I want to thank you so much for all that you're doing to bring about and promote this extraordinarily great time on June 3rd, National Trails Day at Valley Forge National Historical Park. Thanks a lot, Ernestine.
Well, thank you for giving us an opportunity to share information about the event that we're doing here at Valley Forge.
Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for this great opportunity.
Summer's coming. Now go on out and have some fun. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until next Thursday or anytime on the archives when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.